You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Andrew Day.
Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
It's an honor to be here with you for your, what I think, 23rd podcast this week. Is that right?
Close. I've actually done six, one of which wasn't mine. I was lucky to be a guest on the Homebrewed Christianity podcast.
I haven't heard of it. I don't think I have.
It's progressive Christians with a pretty liberal theology.
Okay. Interesting. I'll check that out.
It hasn't aired yet. And I think I actually may run it on our feed as well. I don't know. It was because it was a departure from the norm.
Right on. And I guess we should say this is Earthling Unplugged, where you and I chat about the items from the latest Earthling, which is the Friday edition of the Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. And we also talk about other things, politics, culture. Mm-hmm. And it's also a chance for us to make announcements and do some housekeeping. For example, you have a Zoom call with NZN members coming up. So people who are subscribers, who have a paid subscription on the Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. We had to reschedule that due to a very serious and unforeseen family emergency that's going to happen on July 31st. Huh. You won't be able to make it. So we've moved it back to Wednesday, August 7th. Is that right?
So we know that there's going to be a family emergency on July 31st. That's an unusual emergency. Often you get shorter notice on emergencies, Andrew.
There are some omens. Yes, definitely.
There are omens. Yeah, no, actually, it's a long story. I screwed up. I should have known that I wouldn't go. The reason is family related. It's not an emergency. And I should have known that I couldn't actually do it July 31st. So we're going to do it a week later, Wednesday, August 7th, 8 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. You're not a Non-Zero newsletter member and you'd like to be in the Zoom room. We're going to discuss mainly foreign policy, but I'm also open to other questions. So be there.
Foreign policy, and that will let us discuss, if anyone asks questions about it, your progressive realism piece. I think that's when we first decided to do foreign policy as the theme. So if people want to bring questions about that, that would be good.
To compensate for the fact that the Washington Post, you know, generously ran like a long, like 3,000 words of this. It's even longer edition. In the newsletter. In the print edition, you know, a kind of adapted version. And as it happens, that was the day after the assassination attempt. So the number of people who read that piece in the physical edition of the Washington Post is zero.
Well, maybe. I mean, a lot of people, probably more people than average, picked up the Washington Post that day.
Well,
like, I know my dad will go pick up all the newspapers whenever there's a big happening going on.
That's a heartening way to look at it, Andrew. You should make a living as a therapist or something.
Yeah, I have an optimistic mindset.
Do you really? Is that true? Is that true?
I think maybe more than
you kind of do.
Yeah.
Compared to me.
Generally. I mean, I can be kind of a worrier, I guess, but not too bad. So the Trump assassination thing you just said, I mean, it kind of segues into domestic politics, if you want to talk about that a little bit. Obviously, it's been an extremely tumultuous, chaotic even past couple weeks or even past month. And as the Trump versus Kamala presidential race kicks off in earnest, I think there's one question that's on the minds of all your fans, Bob, which is, are you feeling coconut pilled or at least like coconut curious?
I feel like I just fell out of a coconut tree and it's been an illuminating and enlightening experience. I'm feeling great. No, actually, I am. For reasons that I cannot articulate, I'm feeling a little more optimistic about Kamala Harris. I mean, I always thought she had a better chance than Joe Biden. Yeah. But I thought there were alternatives to her that would have a much better chance than Joe Biden. But I'm kind of feeling the Kamala mojo. I don't know. How about you? There's something in the air, right?
There definitely is. Yeah. Sometimes my analysis of American politics just takes the form of like introspection. Like, how do I feel? And that can be dangerous because then you can extrapolate. People constantly do that and assume that everyone is reacting the way that they are. But yeah, you kind of feel this vibe shift. I mean, it was helped obviously by extremely positive news coverage. I do think I'm more critical than you are, and more suspicious than you are of the process by which Biden was pushed off the ticket and Kamala was kind of, you know, there was this coronation for her.
Mm-hmm.
I might even be willing to kind of defend the coup framing a little bit that you've objected to, although we don't necessarily have to get into that. But yeah, I think I like Kamala. I definitely think she's a more formidable opponent for Trump than Biden is. She can bring the message in a way that Biden, because of his age-related deficiencies, is no longer able to. And on the coconut thing, I said this to you earlier. I mean, I said something like this to you earlier. It's kind of a testament to how stupid our politics is that that whole coconut spiel just became part of the meme war. Meme as in not like Richard Dawkins, but like the stupid internet version of meme. Because you would think instead of focusing on that, conservatives might notice that she was expressing like a pretty conservative insight about, you know, it's like, it's not like left-wing collectivism. It was like right-wing communitarianism, if you get the distinction. Like, she was talking about how we exist in a context, as she put it, how if you want to help young people, you have to be aware that, you know, they're not just individuals. They're shaped by their families and by their educators. And so it's like a whole communal framework that matters when you're thinking about
now,
their
well-being. Did you see the larger clip? All I've seen is the famous very short excerpt. And she just says, my mother used to say, you know, you young people, it's like you fell out of a coconut tree. You know, don't you realize you're connected to you exist in the context of all that's come before and all that is, or something like that. So in other words, you know, you're connected to the past and you're connected to the larger world today.
Yeah, I saw.
Is there more?
I should have looked more into the context of this quote about the context. But yeah, I zoomed out a little bit more than that. And it's still kind of like all about the coconut tree or leading up to the coconut tree. I think she was talking at one point about the environment and then generally about young people. So she might have been expressing this conservative seeming view, like in the service of some, you know, something about social justice or something. But I think you get my point. There's kind of like a coconut conservatism there.
There's a coconut conservatism. I couldn't have put it better, and we'll probably never put it that way again. But I mean, there's also a kind of Eastern vibe. Now, her mother is of Indian heritage, and I'm pretty sure, I assume Hindu, not Buddhist, but this is certainly, but first of all, there's a lot more overlap between early Buddhist philosophy and early Hindu philosophy than is commonly appreciated. In fact, some Hindus have been known to say that perhaps Buddhism is getting too much credit for certain ideas, but one of them is very much the idea. I mean, it sounds cliched when you say, well, you're interconnected with everything. But in Buddhism, that's really explored philosophically. In fact, a version of that underlies the kind of obscure concept of emptiness. And there's other. So it's kind of Eastern to say you are so finely interconnected with everything that thinking of yourself as an independent entity is almost misleading. Not that she said that per se, but there's a lot of directions you could go with this.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm more familiar with like the Western philosophical tradition. So my mind went to like, it's obviously a stretch, but to like Edmund Burke or something, or the people who care a lot about context. But yeah, I should have realized there's like Eastern versions of this, of course. If anything, Eastern thought is thought to be more, and Eastern culture is more about like your ancestors and respecting old people and such.
Well, you think of especially the Confucian tradition in China when you think of that. I mean, in traditional society generally, there's probably a lot more of that than in, say, modern America.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's like, in general, what seems to be happening at this moment is that, like, the forces of Kamala are, like, embracing the memes that have been used against them, kind of.
And that's very smart. I mean, they've handled this pretty deftly. Like, these liberal online supporters were right to make this into, like, a meme thing and to not try to be, you know, hide it and be embarrassed about it.
Mm-hmm. And the laugh, it's a fine laugh. I like laughs. Has Trump ever laughed? Seriously, have we ever heard Trump? It seems like once I did hear him authentically laugh, but I forget what it was.
I did notice, actually, during the Republican convention, someone said something that he found funny. And, you know, the camera's like kind of constantly on him when he's out in the audience. And I thought that's the first time I've ever seen him with like a genuine laugh. Because he tends not to. I was like, oh, maybe he has been changed by this assassination attempt. But before we move on to talking about the first item of the Earthling, which is about Kamala Harris and foreign policy, I am curious. So you don't have any concerns about the way Biden was pushed out? Does it not seem to lack Democratic legitimacy to you?
Well, I mean, as far as the Democratic part, Kamala will be chosen by the delegates who were selected by popular vote. So there's that. Now, as for the way Biden was pushed out, I guess the reason I think coup is misleading first of all, it's not actually a formal position of power. It's to be a candidate, mm-hmm. not to be running anything. You know, he's not resigning. And second, when you think of coups, you think of a different kind of coercion. This had a coercive aspect, but the classic coup is either gun to the head or some other kind of, one way to put it is that first of all, a Democratic commentator said that Nancy Pelosi was in effect saying to Biden, or maybe it said to him, I think in effect is the way to put it, we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way. And one of the conservatives who's characterizing his coup said, I wonder what they meant by the hard way. Well, I know what they meant by the hard way. They meant they were going to get more and more people felt this way and were going to keep speaking out in public.
Yeah.
So that's not a private form of pressure. I mean, can you think of something we'd call a coup where all of the pressure is like transparently applied? Everyone can see it. It's in public. And it just consists of people expressing a view. I mean, I don't know what
you mean. I see what you mean. Although I don't think it's been totally transparent. Like, I would like to see more reporting on what exactly the combination of carrots and sticks was that got him to make this decision. But I was thinking
what
even more like,
what stick do they have other than we will speak out? And I don't know. I'm trying to think, you know.
Well, I also like I was thinking of it more like an American style coup, like in the same way that we talk about propaganda or corruption. Like propaganda in America is much less blunt and overt as in North Korea. You know, it's conveyed mm-hmm. through like a free press or a corporate private media. So that's different, but we still can kind of find the term useful sometimes. And corruption, you know, Bob Menendez notwithstanding, it usually doesn't take the form of like an explicit quid pro quo with like exchanging money or gold bars for someone doing something. But there's kind of a legalized, like above board form of corruption that we have. And
which
yeah,
is like did, what? What? Which is what? I mean, I think of well, corruption like the per se way, as being illegal, but what do you have in mind?
Well, I'm thinking of the relationship between donors and
oh yeah, it is corrupting of the democratic process. That's mm-hmm. true, and that's a huge problem.
And,
oh,
and
well, there, now we know actually that's a good point because that was going on is that donors were saying we are withholding money until you step down, which is pretty coercive. Now that was publicized too. We knew it was happening, mm-hmm. But again, I don't know. It just seems like. These are common forms of pressure in American politics, as you say. I don't know. I guess part of my view is just colored by the fact that it was so obviously something that Biden should have done long ago and Jill should have encouraged. It's just.
No, I totally agree with that. Like, I don't think he should be president. I don't think he should be the candidate. I think Kamala will be a much more formidable candidate.
I mean, also. The conservative coup claims were often cast in these dark terms
mm-hmm.
As if, you know, I mean, some people were really talking as if when he announced it on Twitter, hey, it's weird we haven't seen him, he really was
so
locked
stupid.
Up. And I mean, mm-hmm. it's like the guy has COVID. Give him a couple of days.
No, the paranoid right. As the paranoid right always does, got way ahead of the evidence and then made the whole discussion seem kind of crazy. I don't disagree with that. I just thought it was kind of weird that he and his campaign staff and chief of staff and everything were so adamant that he was going to continue. We're in the race and we're going to win. And I'm not stepping down.
as commentators said, in a situation like this, they always say that until the moment it changes. That's just the smart strategy. Until you've really decided. I thought he was, at some point, I just thought maybe he was gonna, hold his breath until he turned blue. But,
well, should we get into talking about the lead item of today's Earthling?
Sure. I mean, the only other thing I'd say is that, last time I checked, the numbers had improved a little for Kamala. I think some poll must have come out today because Trump was at 65% a week ago on the prediction on the betting markets. And now he's down to 60. It had been like 63, 64, occasionally 62 until today, down to 60. I think maybe a good Michigan poll came out for Kamala or something. I don't know what. But, you know, there is some actual momentum here.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, Biden wasn't as far below in the polls as people think, but Kamala is doing better than he was now, based on the latest polling.
Yeah, I think the betting markets assumed that she wasn't much of an improvement. I'm guessing Biden was at about, they were giving Trump about 65% in any event, but now they are adjusting.
Mm-hmm. For the lead item, it's about a future possible President Kamala Harris. And we're basically asking, what would a President Kamala Harris foreign policy look like? She's a bit of a black box on this issue because prior to being in the Senate, she was Attorney General of California, which is not an office that requires its holder to think very deeply about international affairs, obviously. And as vice president, of course, she's just kind of supported President Biden's foreign policy agenda, which is appropriate. But we write that those who favor U.S. foreign policy restraint, as we do, have some reasons to be optimistic, maybe cautiously optimistic about a Kamala presidency. And you're the one who made the main addition to this item that made it lead worthy. So you want to take it away?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really do the spade work. I think you did more than me, but I was pleasantly surprised. I'm cynical about these things because I consider the foreign policy establishment to be so powerful that there's never much hope, and to be so, you know, kind of stuck in its ways. Mm-hmm. But I will say that it turns out that the guy who's currently her national security advisor as vice president and is thought of as the leading candidate to replace Jake Sullivan as national security advisor if she becomes president is this guy, Philip Gordon, who I didn't know anything about. But look, by definition, he's got to be, in a sense, part of the blob, or a member, certainly a member of good standing of the foreign policy establishment. But as such people go, he's got a lot to be said in his favor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, he was in the Obama administration, after he got out, he wrote a whole book about what a bad idea regime change wars had been. Now, the book was, 2022 it came out?
2020.
And, of course, by that time, that was not a radical idea. Iraq hadn't worked out. Libya hadn't worked out. I think his book goes back much further in time. I think all the way to the 1953 coup in Iran.
Mm-hmm,
but it does. But the thing that really got my attention is that while in the Obama administration, apparently he strongly opposed the policy of arming the Syrian rebels. Now, that seems safe to me to say that that didn't work out well. Especially when you view it as part of the broader arming of rebels that was done not just by us, but by our various friends in the region. That had various agendas and our various rebel groups. I mean, in the end, it just fanned the flames of a civil war. There's over 500,000 people dead, and Assad stayed in power anyway. So it was just, and it's left things more unstable. I would guess that it's prepared the ground for border disputes to come. And he opposed it at the time for real within the White House. And that is, it is, I mean, first of all, among the people who didn't were Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan. Blinken, they were both in the Obama White House, and Sullivan championed arming the rebels. And I think we can safely infer from a Wall Street Journal article we linked to that Blinken did too. And there weren't many people raising doubts about that at the time. Even today, there aren't that many people who complained about that. It seems to me, I just don't hear much about it. And I think it's important because it's like the third element in the trifecta. Okay, we tried regime change by ground invasion, Iraq. We tried it by aerial bombardment, Libya. And then we tried it by proxy war, Syria. Okay, it never works. We've tried everything. And so I think it's important to recognize what a failure that was. And if I can just go on one more second, it's so funny. You sometimes hear people say in like their indictment of Russia. Well, they say the list will be like Chechnya, Syria, and like
Georgia.
Yeah. And only one of those, Georgia. Well, even Georgia is a close call, but at least Georgia is a sovereign country that did not want Russian troops in it. I mean, there are other fuzzy aspects of the way that played out, but, you know, with Chechnya, it was completely brutal. It was horrible, but it was not, it was part of Russia. It was, they were trying to tamp down a separatist movement in Chechnya very brutally. So that's not like us invading Iraq, and neither is them going into Syria, because the Syrian government wanted them in there. So that's not transborder aggression either. And it's funny how people call all of these things Russian, military interventions, but it's often a misleading term. Now, the invasion of Ukraine was the invasion of Ukraine. That was a clear violation of international law, but it just... I mean, and also nobody talks about the fact that we have troops in Syria right now, which is also a violation of international law because the government doesn't want them there. But in any event, end of tangent. This really distinguishes Gordon from a whole lot of people. And then there's also the fact that Daniel Larrison, whose judgment I trust, said that he's been much better on Iran than most people, and so might make it more likely that a Kamala administration would actually pick up on the opportunity posed by this relatively moderate president who was just elected in Iran.
Yeah, and that is good news. I mean, before I knew that Biden was going to be dropping out, I was starting to think that Trump would be more likely than Biden to go to Iran in a kind of Nixon goes to China way and resurrect the Iran deal, because Biden was clearly unwilling to expend the political capital necessary to do that, which would entail like getting hammered for freeing up money for the leaders of Iran. Philip Gordon his position on Syria, as you just laid it out, was very rarely expressed within the foreign policy establishment. Honestly, when I try to think of who was making that argument at that time, the only names that come to mind are like Pat Buchanan and Aaron Maté or something. And whenever you did hear people making that argument about how, you know, it sounds good to fund Assad's, you know, the rebels against Assad, but it could have major blowback, you know, it's the kind of thing where you always have to have all these caveats and prefaces and say Assad is terrible, because you just know that like this opinion is one that you can get criticized for expressing. And I guess we should say we didn't really do like a deep dive on this guy's views on China or really non-Middle East issues, but I do think what we identified is important. And I will say also his book does purport to be more like principled and more categorical in its condemnation of regime change wars than most people are when they argue against regime change wars. I think part of his argument is that presidents kind of misdiagnose why their predecessors' regime change war failed, And they think, well, they just didn't do it right. They, you know, they had the wrong military tactics. They didn't understand the politics of this particular country. But I see like that it's going to work in this case when this new situation mm-hmm. arises, because they didn't have a principled opposition. They're tempted to try basically the same thing. And he kind of lays out why it's like always going to fail.
Yeah. So far I'm impressed. He seems, you know, from my ideological vantage point, clear improvement over Sullivan and Blinken. Mm-hmm. And I hope he will be, if she wins, the national security advisor. He, you know, he currently plays that role for her as vice president, and people seem to think he's the leading candidate.
And you might have mentioned this already, but the Wall Street Journal article you talked about earlier, it also said that Blinken and Sullivan are likely not going to have a part in a Harris administration, which I thought was interesting because I kind of thought she might want to hold on to some of these Biden people, but apparently not.
I also think they're both kind of tarnished by Gaza, and it's not like at the moment they're looking that great over Ukraine. It's not like that's a smashing success. But I think the association with Gaza is honestly baggage that won't help them for the rest of their careers. I'm guessing neither one will ever hold a high position in government again, and they'll go straight into the world of lobbying or whatever and stay there.
Mm-hmm. Did you happen to see Kamala Harris meeting with Netanyahu in advance of some? She met privately with him after Biden did. Did you see any of that?
I saw this little speech she gave, a little 5-10 minute thing she said afterwards, which was, you know, it was very, it was balanced. It started off by affirming the things that you affirm about Israel generally in these cases and their right to defend themselves and so on. But when she got around to talking about the plight of Palestinians, it seemed more heartfelt than what you hear from Biden or God knows, you know, the spokespeople, Matt Miller and what's his name? Kirby?
John Kirby.
So, you know, and also substantively, I would say there was a little more balance. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very tough issue for an American politician. But she seems to be paying attention to the, you know, the part of the progressive constituency that's very upset about Gaza. I noticed that in the prediction markets, Josh Shapiro's, governor of Pennsylvania's, chances of being vice president have gone from, like, I don't know, 38 to 24 or something. And I think that's because he's getting heat because he's been very, you know, kind of ardently pro-Israel. He has supported legislation that, you know, anti-BDS legislation that some people consider anti-free speech, withdrawing funding from universities based on their positions and so on. And, you know, we had that item months ago in the newsletter that was just about how things get distorted on social media on both sides of the Gaza issue. We looked at examples from both sides. But one case was this restaurant Goldie's in Philadelphia, where pro-Palestinians were protesting. And, you know, Josh Shapiro, among other people, condemned the protests as anti-Semitic because it was a Jewish-owned restaurant. But the Philadelphia Inquirer did a piece on what was actually going on, and that wasn't what the protest was over. Allegedly, they had fired a worker for wearing a Palestinian flag pin. I don't know if that was true or not, but that was the reason the protest was happening. And Shapiro kind of rushed in and made the judgment that apparently, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, was not well-founded. So,
yeah, I think it doesn't. I think she shouldn't pick him for all these reasons. I mean, she would only be doing it to pick up Pennsylvania.
Well, that's a big pickup.
It is a big pickup, but I mean, it probably would matter. But, you know, politics used to be a lot more regional. Now it's more partisan. And so I don't think it matters quite as much as it used to for, like, it used to be you could boost your vote by like 20% or something by picking a VP candidate from a particular state. I think it's much less of a boost now.
I think that's true, although he apparently is very popular in Philadelphia and comes off well, and I think handles the Trump issue well, which is to say he sounds not too resistancy about.
What do you think about? I think Mark Kelly. I think I was saying Roy Cooper, but I think Mark Kelly is the best.
Mark Kelly is leading the prediction markets right now. He's in the 30s now.
And he's like a fighter pilot, an astronaut. He's popular among Republicans in a border state and apparently talks a lot about and thinks a lot about like border issues, yet maintains this popularity among Republicans and moderates.
Yeah, and you know, Arizona is kind of a swing state, I think, and not as populous as Michigan or Pennsylvania, but he's currently leading. Yeah. And I think with Shapiro, the concern may be that although he would help in Pennsylvania, which would be a lot, he could hurt in Michigan because of the Arab American population.
Yeah. And that would be at least as big a loss as Pennsylvania would be big a win. But I think we should probably transition to the overtime segment of this episode.
Yeah. And people can become, they can join us if they are Non-Zero newsletter members. And you know, becoming a member, you know how on NPR, well, you don't know, young people never listen to NPR, right? Have you ever heard of NPR? Do you know what NPR is?
I used to like it a lot. They used to do some really interesting shows like Radiolab and like weird sciencey stuff, but I feel like they don't do as much of that as they used to.
Well, also you can get what you want on demand, but anyway, when I first moved to where I live, the great thing about it was that you could get NPR stations from both Philadelphia and New York. And back then they didn't have their pledge week at the same time. So when it was pledge week on one NPR station, you could just listen to the other. But back to pledge week, they always said, you know, for the price of a cup of coffee, it's actually true. Thanks to inflation.
Yeah.
That's truer than ever.
A Starbucks cappuccino is about what you'd pay.
Once a month. You know, one a month, folks. Sacrifice one cappuccino a month, probably good for you anyway. You could be a Non-Zero newsletter member.
And you don't just get the overtime segments of podcasts. We're doing more early access. We had Nick Bostrom, the philosopher, who's very influential among AI people. And that's still early access. Only members can watch that at the moment. And then now Dmitry Alperovich, is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah, China Hawk. I had a vigorous debate with, and that will post publicly probably next week, but it's available to members now. He's author of a new book called World on the Brink.
And then, of course, written content, everything below the paywall and the Earthling. I don't know if NZM members even realize that a lot of what they're reading is below the paywall because they don't see that. And then for the rest of this episode, we're going to talk about Israel-Palestine, Netanyahu's visit, his speech in Congress, and the top world court's ruling on Israel's settlements in the West Bank or its occupation of the West Bank. We're going to talk about some tech stuff, why sanctions backfire, why America's chip war against China is backfiring, and some other stuff.
It's a lot. Okay, let's go to overtime.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.